Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Plumbing Game Studies, a podcast from the English and Comparative Literature Department, the Critical Game Studies Initiative, I should say, in ECL from UNC Chapel Hill. My guest today is Tee Nguyen, and it is T's fault that this podcast exists and that I'm seriously working on philosophy of games, because it was a conversation with him that got me started on all this. So first, let me just say, T, thank you for coming back on the podcast, and just thank you for starting me on this journey. This has been awesome.
I'm sorry. I apologize from the bottom of my heart.
I mean, apology accepted, because it is an obsession now. So it is taking up way too much of my time and energy, but also I'm just plowing it back into to teaching and research. So
I mean, yeah, hopefully you're seeing what I was starting to see, which is, you know, games and play are not studied in philosophy, and they're so incredibly rich, and there's just so much games have to teach us about everything. And the way my friend Jonathan Gingrich, who's a philosopher, we started these projects together. Actually, our project started as a co-authored paper that broke apart. And his way of putting it is that theories of agency and rationality and motivation in philosophy, but also outside in like political science and economics, those were built by people interested in morality and government and economic theory. And they have this image of this very straightforward agent. And games and play and beauty don't fit into that picture. But that's not the fault of games or beauty or play. That's the fault of these overly narrow, restrictive theories that were built to model like political or economic or like the worst moral interactions. And so if you start looking at games and play, then this whole other world of like interesting ways that human beings are just opens up for you. And I mean, for me, if you're in the same place, then I think you might be seeing how weird this goes.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I am in that same place. And the only thing I need to add is that, you know, the economist James K. Galbraith has said that, you know, economics is not really like an empirical science. It's really a branch of moral philosophy that comes exactly out of that contract tradition that you are talking about, that imagines the worst possible world and the worst possible ways of people interacting with one another. And right now we're told that pretty much all decisions have to be run through the metric of economics. But then you realize that economics isn't even done scientifically. And in fact, they seem to imagine that the world is one big game, the economists do, but they don't understand games or how they work or why people play them.
And exactly. So, yes. Thank you. So, yes, 100%.
All right. Well, we've already gotten started with this, because my first question I'm trying to ask all of these games philosophers as they come along is, how did you get interested in games? Again, you've started it, but you keep going and take us to Suits.
Right. So I've been a game player my entire life. I grew up 20, like my 4-year-old kid has now shown interest in board games. And we were playing this weekend, and I was the same, like at 4 years old, I was into like board games. I grew up playing lots of computer games, playing Dungeons and Dragons. This went away for a while during college, and then during graduate school, which, I mean, is in the early aughts, right? I was poking around, and I rediscovered this thing of what is now known as Eurogaming or German board gaming, like this revolution that had come out. And so I was there. I was in philosophy grad school, but a lot of my spare time I spent either rock climbing, which I now believe to be a game, or playing these incredibly interesting, subtle, wonderfully designed games coming out of Europe, mostly Germany, from the people that are my heroes now, especially Rainer Knizia and Wolfgang Kramer, who are just these like geniuses of innovative like design mechanics. And I spent a lot of time on a site that I think a lot of people listening to this probably know, BoardGameGeek, just like hashing out like what was interesting about these games, what like made these games so rich, and so, like why were these games so interesting? Like it was, I now realize in retrospect, like hammering out an aesthetic language for a new form. And at the same time, I'd occasionally, you know, I do philosophy of art and aesthetics, and I was always like, oh, you know, wouldn't it have been great to have been around in the 50s and write about jazz as it was coming out, and without making any kind of connection, going online and board game geek and be like, well, what this Knizia game has such an interesting decision process. How do we describe, right? But all this happened. But this was not like, it had never even occurred to me to write about this academically. Like, I was in the kind of philosophy program where it wasn't that people would laugh at you for proposing a topic on games. Like, that wasn't even thinkable. And somehow this thing happened. I think what happened was I was close to the end of my dissertation. I was teaching some philosophy of art courses. And I always wanted to do a case study. So the first time I was like, okay, cool case study. It'll get all the kids riled up. We're going to do whether comic books can actually be art. It totally flopped because, you know, it was like 2008 by this point. And my undergraduates were just confused that anyone would ever deny comic books were an art. I mean, they grew up in the era of like Mouse and Watchmen, and they were all like, what? Like, it was just incomprehensible to them. And they were like, this is not interesting. What, like, old asshole thinks that comic books are an art form? So I tried again with video games, and that was actually live for them. Like, even though they grew up playing games, whether or not games were an art form was super interesting to them. And I read through, and this stuff has made its way into the book. So I read through a bunch of academic work in philosophy and outside of philosophy about games as an art form, and it all pissed me off because it was all mostly about how games tell stories, are narratives, make arguments. It had this very like text-centric, rigid, narrative-centric view. And you could read whole books that were all about representationality and character and script and graphics and completely ignored gameplay mechanics, design mechanics, and in particular, the way things shaped action. And on the other hand, I was reading these like really interesting game critics. So Board Game Geek, a bunch of people. There's this site called Action Button, written by, God, I can't remember his name now. Now he's a game critic for Kotaku. Like, that was a brilliant site. Reading all these game developer diaries and being like, this is the real shit. These people, like, and it would always be these like subtle design commentaries about, oh, you add this mechanic and players like totally shift their mood. And none of that was in the academic work I was looking at. I realized there was a little bit out there, but most of the stuff I was seeing was so, this is a fiction, this is a movie. And I got really mad. And this became like originally a tiny project. And I was like, I'm just going to write one little paper about this. No one cares. No one likes games and philosophy. I just need to get this off my chest because I have this one idea. And then every time I would tug at it, like something new would show up. And eventually it became this entire view, the view that's in the center of my book, which is games are distinctive as an art form because they manipulate agency itself. They manipulate our desires and our abilities. And for me, this is not supposed to be an original view. This is supposed to be the basic view that almost everyone in the actual game development and gameplay space has, who are like kind of naturally, right? That game designers have always had, that most people on Board Game Geek have, that so many game critics have. But in it, I kept seeing this thing where people would talk about gameplay mechanics, gameplay, and then they'd be like, well, for serious games, we have to talk about narrative. And then they'd turn over because that was the kind of theory that was available. And so I'm like, so for me, and somewhere along these lines, I found Suits too, which we're going to talk about. My advisor, Calvin Normore, handed me this book when I was starting, just barely talking about this. And I read it and I was like, fuck, this is it. This is everything. And so being involved in games, trying to articulate, trying to use my like philosophy of art background to give a better language to what I think people are already saying, right? And then fusing this with what I found in Suits, which I think we're going to talk about soon, was where a lot of what I was working on came from. Because I think Suits and his views about games as a kind of constructed struggle fit incredibly naturally and well with everything I was reading on game designer diaries and dev blogs in a way that a lot of the other theory didn't. And so it just went.
Yeah, that's all wonderful. I do want to stress, how much I completely agree with you about the study of games. As I've gotten into game studies, it does seem, you know, so the things that crop up is obviously there's, I mean, really the stuff that I'm used to from the English department and, you know, in film studies. So there's games as narrative, games as ideology, and you can think of sort of like criticisms of identity and like, you know, the embedded racistness or Eurocentrism or heteronormativity of games, the same way that we critique books for this thing. And then of course there's the whole like fandom and games as culture angle. And I view all of these as important and valid ways of studying games in the same way they're important and valid ways of studying novels and poetry and movies and everything else. But it wasn't until I found your work and through you Suits that I found anyone talking about games as games. There's a big stigma when you're talking about film. If you never discuss cinema as cinema, and it only seems to be stories and ideas and ideologies that have just been somehow abstracted, and people, at least the people I hang out with, get upset when they read a book about movies that never talks about how the movies are made, why they are made, and what they're doing. And most of game studies seems to be doing this, and you and Suits are not. And that's what's thrilling to me, because I'm trying to figure out how I would make a game, how I would teach a class or write about the original Super Mario Brothers or one of the early Zelda games, because the tools of analysis that are like, oh, look at this history, look at this ideology, they're not going to be there. Only something like a Suitsian analysis of games as constrained play and agency is going to allow you to write about Super Mario Brothers, I think, or Mario Kart.
I mean, I want to pause and say there's actually a ton of stuff in game studies that takes the ludological part of games seriously. One of my favorite essays that you should look at is a video essay from Frank Lance about poker and Go, and talking about the essentially different spirits of these things, about how Go is about the serenity and calm, and he has this incredible set of passages about how poker's aboutness, and he's talking about the gameplay aboutness, is basically filthy and seedy. And he ends up saying, like, you know, when you think about poker, it's you think about like people getting drunk and like smoking cigarettes in gross places. And that's no accident, because the essential play about poker is about managing out of control randomness and managing your emotions and managing going on tilt and like getting too angry about bad draws. And like that heart of poker, that aboutness of poker, is built. So there's stuff like this. But I mean, it's, you see this throughout. This is not just games. This repeats throughout the history, the art history. Every time there's a new medium, people scramble to make it like the old medium and to analyze it in terms of the old medium. Like early photography criticism mostly tries to treat it as impressionist painting and get some of it and then doesn't get other parts of it. And again, I think we have to mark 100%. There's a lot of value in thinking about games as a narrative and thinking about how ideology sneaks into games, thinking about racist and patriarchal views in games. But one of the things that's really interesting is the degree to which it's easy to use the tools and language that are available that reframe what you're doing in terms of, you know, narrative, fiction. So some of the new stuff that's actually great. So Stephanie Patridge, who's a feminist philosopher of art, who you talk to, she's amazing. She has interesting feminist criticisms of games, but she's like not obsessed like a lot of old school people are with like the story. She actually does an analysis of game creation screens and like the ways that like gender bias sneaks in or can be ameliorated through the kind of sliders you get. So that's games native. Yes. That is a particular experience that's specific to games. So for me, it's not the games don't tell stories, but another way to put it is a lot of the stuff that we see out there emphasizes the relationship between video games and films. And that's definitely there. But they de-emphasize the relationship between, say, video games and sports or card games or board games. And one of the things that's interesting about the Suitsian analysis is it's an account of games. I'm sure we should get this in a second.
Yes.
That unifies video games, board games, sports, card games. And if you use that as the starting point, then you're going to look for unities over there and relationships over there. And I think all of those will end up going into the story. But for me, the incredibly unique thing about game design is the way it structures action and structures agency through the manipulation of points and rule systems and environment and obstacles. And that's distinctive. And when you understand that, and then you fuse it with the already rich tools we have for understanding narrative, you'll understand the heart of the thing.
Yeah, I think that's right. That's awesome. So I guess it is time for us to get to Suits. So this book, just to briefly describe it, it's called The Grasshopper, and it is, you know, it is the famous grasshopper who didn't store up food for winter and therefore died. But he's also kind of Socrates and also Jesus, and he's telling he's doing a Platonic dialogue about games. It's beautifully written. It's amazing. I don't even know if this is important, but I want to ask, I know nothing about Suits besides this book. Is there anything? Suits was a 20th century philosophy professor. Yeah. That's all I know. Is there anything we need to know besides The Grasshopper?
This will show up, but he was an Aristotle scholar and an Aristotle fanboy. And I think the book is deeply, deeply Aristotelian in its guts. I often teach him as like a fusion between existentialism and Aristotelianism. We'll talk about this. That's a lot of verbiage to just suddenly drop. But so I got actually to meet some of his friends and talk to his widow. He was up in the University of Waterloo. He was an Aristotle scholar and taught Aristotle classes, started writing this stuff, and basically in the 70s, wrote some material that would form the basis for a lot of work people are doing now that was incredibly insightful. And at the time, almost no one recognized it. So his widow told me he basically died like unhappy, that he thought he'd birthed this beautiful thing and it had just gotten ignored. Yeah. And Tom Herka, who is another philosopher who kind of kept the flame alive for this incredible book that could have easily died out, says that if Suits had survived for like another 2 or 3 years, he would have seen suddenly the takeoff with like game study stuff of people realizing how incredible his view is. So his view is, we should just put down the basics of the view. He has a definition of games that he thinks solves the problem of how you define games. I don't actually think this is true. We can talk about why if you want. But I think it's this incredibly interesting conceptual analysis. So there's a short version and the long version. And since this is about Suits, we should do both. So the short version is that to play a game is to voluntarily take on unnecessary obstacles to create the activity of striving to overcome them. Once again, to play a game is to voluntarily take on unnecessary obstacles to create the activity of struggling to overcome them. So you could already see this. Obviously, it's about voluntariness and about obstacles, but the key idea is this creation of the activity. So one of the notions that's central in Suits is that the goals in games and the activity of the game are new things that we made up with rules. He often puts it in terms of, in a lot of games, there's a goal that you're trying to achieve, and you can put it in really plain terms. So if you're running a marathon, there's the finish line. But the point of running the marathon is not simply to get to that point in space. Because if you were just interested in that, just being there, there are more efficient ways to do it. You could take an Uber, you could ride a bicycle, you could take a shortcut. What you want to do is get there inside certain constraints. So you want to do it by running with your own feet, following a particular course that will take 26.6 miles, right? So that means whatever it is that you're trying to do, the philosophical language for me is that the goal is constituted in part by the constraints. If you didn't run with your own feet, you didn't cross the finish line. You got to that point, but you didn't cross the finish line. Crossing the finish line is essentially constituted by a relationship to constraints, which means that the value has to be somewhere in doing it inside those constraints. Same thing, I think another way to put it is in basketball, you can describe this in two ways. You can pass the ball through the net or you can make a basket. And making a basket is passing the ball through the net while obeying all these other rules, right? If you grab a stepladder and you stand up the top of the stepladder and just pass the ball through the net like a million times. You've gotten the ball through the net, but you haven't made any baskets. I'm doing big air quotes, right? So whatever it's, if the, so another way to put it is that if there's something especially valuable about making a basket that's more valuable than passing the ball through the net, then whatever that value is has to have some unbreakable connection to the constraints. So the activities are, so another way to put it is in normal life, instrumental practical life, we just do the minimum necessary to get what we want. We just engage in the most efficient instrumental activity to get some separate goal. The value of the goal. So if I just want to get to goddamn Target to get my kid some Play-Doh, sorry, true story, this was the drama of yesterday. There was a snowstorm and my four-year-old wanted some goddamn Play-Doh. Right? If the goal is just to get to Target, to get to Play-Doh, you're going to take the most efficient route because the constraint, getting Play-Doh is just valuable separately from any constraints. But if you're running a race, it's different. Right? So that's the portable version. Do you want me to do the full version now, or is that enough to?
Yeah. I mean, I kept waiting to find a way that I could just rephrase the version you had given to make sure that the listener got it, but I don't find that necessary. I think you've, this idea that the activity is constituted, you know, by the constraints. I think you've done right. It perfectly. So I have nothing to add.
That's just suits. That's it. I mean, yeah. Another way he'll put it is like games are weird because they're not doing things as efficiently as possible because you would take a shortcut, and they're not doing things as inefficiently as possible. Instead, they're taking on certain inefficiencies and then trying to work as efficiently as you can inside of them. And so those inefficiencies that you take on, he considers those constitutive inefficiencies. So for example, basketball, the dribbling requirement is a constitutive inefficiency. You have to be engaged in it to be playing basketball. Playing with your eyes closed isn't constitutive. That's just bad basketball. And the weirdness of that is just that basketball is a constructed activity where certain things are the rules and certain things aren't. So the full version, let me just get, because I think we're going to need this if we're going to do a full session on suits. So everything I've said before, here's how suits puts it in full terminology. So the full definition of a game is something where A, there's a pre-losery goal. Losery, ludos means game. So you're going to hear this term a lot. So a pre-losery goal is the description of a state you're trying to achieve without reference to any rules. So the pre-losery goal of a marathon is being at a certain point in space. Then you add the constitutive rules. Those are the rules that make up the game. And when you achieve the pre-losery goal inside the constitutive rules, that's the losery goal. The losery goal is that pre-losery goal plus some constitutive rules. So making a basket, crossing the finish line, doing it by the rules, that is the losery goal. And in all games, there's this gap, right? There's a difference between the losery goal and the pre-losery goal. That's what makes it a game. And then to play a game is to take on all of the above in order to make possible the activity you're engaged in. Another way to put it is that basketball is a thing, a new activity that comes into being when you take on these constraints. I often think of it as like this. I sometimes have an argument in my head with an old friend of mine, Megan, who used to be like, I don't see why we play games. This just makes us, these rules just make us less free. And I think Suits has an answer, which is you add the rules and you actually create new possibilities because you're creating a new kind of action. So I've given this argument to Megan and I think she accepts it, but still like kind of frowns at me, another philosopher who, the making a pass, right? Making a three-pointer, like blocking, all of these are new activities that didn't exist until you add in the rules of basketball. So that suits his vision, that you have this new activity, these new actions that come into being. And if there's a special value to playing a game, it has to be in the kind of action that's constructed by these new rules that didn't exist beforehand. It's not just in the goal independently. It's in the activity. I think that suits his account. In the end part of the book, there's all the stuff about the definition. In the final part of the book, maybe the cool part, or for some people the stupid part, is the utopian argument, where he argues something like, in games, sorry, in imagine Utopia. Utopia is where all our practical problems are solved. What would we do with our time? We would play games. Therefore, games are the meaning of life. This argument pisses people off, but you can just restate it as an Aristotelian argument, right? Suits was an Aristotelian. Aristotle thought that the value of human life was not in outcomes or products, but in activity itself, right? Exercising your capacity excellently, like displaying the virtue of acting. And you might say, like, look, okay, so if you want to act for its own sake, not to get something else, but just to be acting itself, what is that? Definitionally, that's a goddamn game. That is Suits's, I think, actual argument, that games are the meaning of life. That's why I'm writing a book about games and the meaning of life. Games are the meaning of life because they're the only activity that you do for its own sake and not to get something else out of it. And Aristotle thought that's where the meaning of life had to come from. So that's it. Games are the meaning of life.
I mean... So first, what is there to say? I mean, the first thing to say is I'm more or less sold on this idea that games are the meaning of life. The place where I disagree with Suits, and I've mentioned this to you before, and I don't know if it's worth our time in going into it now, is as you say, like, his definition of a game actually doesn't hold up as well, and he does seem to think that he has solved. He seems to think that he solved the question that's put by the first philosopher I did in this series, Ludwig Wittgenstein, who says, maybe he doesn't quite say that you can't define a game. Yone Arjaranta, who was on the show to talk about this, says, you know, that's not quite what Wittgenstein says. But the way you put it, I think it is what Wittgenstein says. Wittgenstein says there is no way to unify everything that is called a game into a, you know, a unified theory of gameness, just like there's no unified theory of breadness. And Suits claims to have unified everything, and I find this to be not true. But I'm also a Jamesian pragmatist, and his definition of games is incredibly useful and stimulating. So the fact that in some grand sense it may not be capital T true, right, does not bother me in the slightest. I don't do that kind of epistemology.
I mean, I'll just give you, I don't think we should spend a huge amount of time on this. There's more interesting terrain. I'll give you the reason so basically, to summarize the dispute between Suits and people like me, Suits thinks all autotelic activity, that is activity that's worth doing for its own sake, is games. I think there are at least two categories, games and art.
Yes.
Suits thinks that all art is a type of game. And this is basically the stupid technical disagreement I have with Suits. And it goes like this. Sorry, I'll do this. This is the first thing I ever wrote in this space. So what about make-believe? What about engaging in imagination for its own sake? Suits thinks make-believe is a kind of game. I don't think imaginative make-believe is a kind of game because I don't think it's goal-structured in the same way. I think it's more free-form. There's not a specified goal. I have this old argument, the first thing I ever wrote, where I was like, look, so there's this one other philosopher, Kendall Walton, who's a theorist of make-believe, where he thinks make-believe is using props to imagine things. And he thinks that struggling games are a kind of make-believe. And Suits thinks, no, make-believe is a kind of struggling game. Yeah. I think, no, they're both wrong. Here's the argument. The way you break a struggling game is you break the rules. That's called cheating. The way you break a make-believe game is by breaking the illusion, and those are different. Yeah. And here's the reason. You can games lawyer a Dungeons & Dragons game, and you're breaking the goddamn illusion, but you're not cheating, in fact, right? But maybe here's a deeper way of putting it. Suits has this lovely, interesting side article that I think he wrote after the book called Why a Sonnet Isn't a Game. And his argument is that in a game, the goals are constituted by certain constraints, so you can't break the constraints to get the goals better. But you can break the constraints to make a better poem. So here's the example. If you're writing a sonnet, you're obeying these constraints to get to get a good poem. And you might get to the point where you're like, oh, you know what? If I broke one of the sonnet rules, it would be a better poem. And you can do it because the idea of a good poem is independent of the constraints. On the other hand, if you're playing a game of chess, you cannot break the rules of chess to get a better game of chess. That's a classically Suetian game.
Yeah.
I now think this is, by the way, if you're wondering, hardcore gamers who've read my book often ask why role-playing games aren't in there. In the game, when I was writing it, I was like really confused about them, and now I can say why. I don't think role-playing games are a Suetian game. Here's why. You can break the rules during the game to tell a better story. We do it all the time. When we play role-playing games, you do not throw away rules of chess, mid-chess, that tears apart the activity, because chess is a classically Suetian game. If you're playing a role-playing game all the time, the narrative's going and you just start ignoring rules left and right because you're onto a better narrative. So I think Suetz's account does not capture tabletop role-playing. Tabletop role-playing is an aesthetic act that I think is obviously autotelic. And so the constraint-constituted activity doesn't fully exhaust the category of activity that's valuable in itself. There is the geeky, nerdy, technical reason why I do not think that Suetz is... I guess it's just that maybe the less trivial way of saying it is I don't think he actually captures the category of art, and art is another important category of activity that's valuable for its own sake. So we have at least two. Maybe there are more.
Well, I just want to say to bring it back to the work itself, and again, that's something that I talked about with Jana when we were talking about Wittgenstein and we brought up Suetz a bit, is, so Rorty has this great line that I used in the introduction episode of this podcast of, like, he says analytic philosophy is, you know, is sort of a game, and, you know, if you don't do it right, you'll get trapped in a corner.
Right.
And the reason why it's so important that we're talking about this is because this idea of whether make-believe is a game or not is actually very important to, like, the book, The Grasshopper, becomes not very interesting in the middle third because he spends, I don't know, 40 or 60 pages trying to make the game of make-believe fit in the Suetzian definition, which to me is the classic, like, Rortian, he's in a corner.
Right.
And he's in a corner for whatever analytic philosophy reasons that he just needs to step out of the corner.
I just figured out a better way to put this.
Okay.
Which I had not figured out before we were talking. So there's another category of Aristotelian value that he's missing out on. So Tal Brewer, who's one of my favorite philosophers working right now, has this book called Retrieval of Ethics. He talks about activities where, as you're doing them, you discover the value of them, and that constantly changes how you do the activity. And one of his examples is philosophy. You do philosophy for a while, you think you know what it's for, and then you get a better view of the activity, and then you change what you're doing, right? And you steer, you change course a little bit, you do the activity differently, and that enriches your sense of value. And that just goes on and on. And I think, like, that... the way that a value illuminates itself as you continue, I mean, I don't know if this argument works, but I think there's something in activities like philosophy and art where the larger reason we do it is unfixed or discovered, and the rules are malleable and changeable on the fly, that's distinctive from Suetzian games. And I think that's an important, that's like another part of a full, rich life. But there you go.
No, I think that's great. It's very important. It gets to, you know, the biggest part of your book that I am thinking about right now is this definition of art. And maybe I shouldn't go here, but here you are, and we're here. It's just thinking about art is your account of art for the most part in that book is fairly Suetzian when you're talking about board games as art. And then when we look at the history of art, we generally, the art we talk about is generally the art that has broken the rules of how art is made in the previous generation. And that, for me, is the danger of a Suetzian sense of games as art, because you're going to get locked in to this sense of game that is difficult to get out of. And so many of the games that you talk about in that book wouldn't have counted as games in previous generations, if that makes sense. I haven't worked through this yet, so that's why I was going to write something. That's why I shouldn't have brought it up, but feel free to respond or just say no and we can move on.
I'm not sure. I'd have to think about that
okay.
for a bit, because the problem is that the Suitsian definition allows you to change the game. You're just playing a different game now. So you can evolve the game you're playing by making edits to it. So I don't know. I'd have to think about that more.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I have thoughts on that as well, but let's leave that for now and just keep going with Suits. So tell us, now that we've established, I think really well, what Suits is doing and, you know, some of the limitations, what makes this so useful for right. thinking about games? If someone's interested in game studies, how can they use Suits and why should they?
Right. I think the worst way to use Suits is to insist that he's correctly defined the natural language notion of a game. I mean, as you can see, I think Dungeons and Dragons is a game. Don't think Suits' definition fits that. I think what he has done is chart an incredibly valuable space of activities that are done, that are constraint constituted, where what you're doing is made up of by the constraint. And I think what's really valuable about him is a value theory. He's giving you a theory where if there's a special value to games, it's the value of doing constraint constituted quests. And whatever the value of that is, it can't be in the simple end product in and of itself. So in my book, I introduced this distinction that I think is in Suits, but he didn't make it explicit. And so I think people missed it. And so I wanted to give it language. And so for me, it's a distinction between striving play and achievement play. So there are two motivations that you can play a Suitsian game in. Achievement play is playing it for the value of winning. And striving play is temporarily taking an interest in winning for the value of engagement in the activity itself. And one of the ways you can tell the difference is if someone is an achievement player and they lost the game, then that was a valueless activity, right? Maybe they gained the skills to win next time, but the cash value of the activity has to show up as winning at some point. But for striving players, you can lose the game and have a great time, right? I mean, I think this is the relationship most of us have to party games. I have two arguments in the book that there's striving play is real. One is that sometimes we, in the short term, try really hard to win because that's how you get the pleasure in the game. But in the long term, we avoid the actions that would make us better at winning. So my standard example is, my spouse and I play a lot of board games, and often when we actually get evenly matched, and the games are great, I will not read a strategy guide. Because reading a strategy guide would make me win. My spouse will never read strategy guides. And then the games turn boring. So if the value was winning, I should just read the damn strategy guide, right? But I don't, because I want an evenly balanced game. I want that struggle. The other argument is the stupid games argument. Consider the category of stupid games. A stupid game is a game where the fun part is failing, but it's only fun if you're trying to win, like Twister, right? So think about the weirdness of Twister. It's hilarious if we fall, but if you fall on purpose, it's not hilarious. So you have to try to win because you actually want to fail, but you have to get yourself in the mental state of winning, wanting to win. And that weirdness, I think, is just lying under the surface in Suits. So what Suits really has for us is this view that what games are, their essence, is manipulating goals and manipulating rules and constraints to shape a particular activity, to bring a new activity into being. And that's basically like all I said in my book, in some sense, was like, yeah, that's him giving a definition of games. But that's also just a vision of what the artistic medium of games is. The artistic medium of games is just the specification of the illusory goal and the constitutive rules. And that sounds exactly like when you look at what board game developers and video game developers are doing, how they talk about how the construction of gameplay mechanics. Oh, you change the point scheme a little. You change the ranking system. You add this rule. You add this constraint. You add this little bit of obstacle. And the player's activity shapes. Suits gives us the language to talk directly about the manipulation of rules and goals to shape and bring into being new kinds of activity. That's it. That's what you get out of suits.
Yeah, that's perfect. It's perfect. And it ties us into the existential aspect of it. So we've got the Aristotelian part, and now we need the existential aspect of it, or the utopian aspect, which is that this is the meaning of life. And obviously, you know, I've been working in the anarchist tradition for a few years, so this is very compatible here, but it's also compatible with the pragmatist tradition with Rorty or Dewey. So one way, I mean, this is kind of Rorty's story, and it's probably Dewey's story as well, but despite the fact that I've read thousands of pages of Dewey, I'm still unclear on what he's saying because he doesn't say it clearly, which is frustrating. But it's something like, you know, human activity itself is, you know, in some ways this kind of forced thing where we're making up the rules ahead of time and then acting our agency within that. And you might want to give it some constraints, like, oh, like you need food and shelter and that's fine. But the vast majority of us are not actively working on just food and or shelter. And Rorty's version of this is essentially like what you are supposed to do in your life was at one point in time, and Rorty's history is always really poor and sloppy, but I still think this is roughly true. What you're supposed to do in life was determined by God or some sort of external value structure. And we have this new really shitty thing called like science or the real world or something, which has for Rorty just replaced God in Western philosophy. So we still have rules that we are supposed to follow, and scientists are just discovering these rules empirically. And Rorty and Dewey are having none of it. And they say what a human society is the constant setting of its own goals and then doing human activity within these goals. And that being meaningful, not because it corresponds to what God wants or the truth of the universe or the laws of our ancestors, but it being meaningful because we have chosen this activity and we have chosen to create it and make it meaningful. And that, to me, when you combine that with Suits's sense of games, is something that can go far beyond games and open up this new analytical tool for, well, I mean, goddamn everything.
Right. So, okay. Let me tell you a quick story. So I was about my favorite student interaction ever. Teaching this intro philosophy class, and during it, I teach a lot of the Scott stuff we talked about last time, and I teach Suits, and I teach a lot of the classics like Kant and Aristotle. And a student, and she was, I think, pre-med, super hard worker, and she loved Kant. She thought Kant was great. This view of the autonomy of life. She loved Aristotle, you know, excellently exercising capacities. She hated Suits. She hated the utopian argument. She thought that the life of playing games was the worst argument of all time, and it offended her sensibilities. So we're at the last day of class before the final, I'm doing review session, and we run through everything. The students asked me to re-explain Kant. I re-explained Kant. The students asked me to re-explain Aristotle. I re-explained Aristotle. And the student, she's like, okay, so I love Kant, and I love this idea that, you know, value is whatever you choose. It's freedom, and you invent value by choosing things. And I love Aristotle and this idea that we have a function, and we're meaningful when we're excellently fulfilling our function, excellently engaged in activity. But is there any way to combine them? And I was like, yeah, you know, how would you combine them? You would want a view where what was valuable in life was the difficult activity that you voluntarily chose. Do we have a view that's like that? And then she just screamed from the back of this classroom, this like agonized howl, as she saw that Suits was the fusion she wanted. And I think that's really it. Like, so Aristotle's like view of the value of activity is that it's in being excellent. And I think, as you say, like that's kind of an interestingly external account. There's not a lot of choice in that, and you can see this in. So I'll pick on my buddy Tom Harka. So Tom Harka is a friend and mentor and a philosopher, and one of the people that kept the frame alive for Suits. The flame alive for Suits. He shepherded this book, but Harka's reading is a very non-existential, very old school Aristotelian reading of Suits. So in Games of the Good, Herka says, the way we understand Suits is that games are valuable because they make us do difficult activity, and difficult activity is anything that's very complex where you should organize a bunch of things, period. Notice that that's eliminated the notion of voluntariness and choice. As John Tessullius, a philosopher who responded to Herka, said, if you just believe this, there's all kind of boring-ass difficult things that this will force you to do. But Suits, I think, Suits is not quite Aristotelian. He's the existential Kant plus Aristotelian. He wants you to take on the activity that's valuable for its own sake that you chose. And it doesn't, and in my view, it doesn't have to be difficult. It can be easy if you want it, if that's what's beautiful, right? So that's one of the big divergences, and this is where I think that is Suits' wrinkle on Aristotle. And I kind of think, weirdly enough, that if you want a meaning of life story that fuses voluntariness with activity for its own sake, then that's what Suits was trying to do. Like, secretly, he was trying to make existentialism and Aristotelianism talk and give you this picture where activity, where what was valuable in life, was meaningful activity you chose yourself, not that the world forced on you to get something else. And once again, definitionally, that's a game for Suits.
Yeah, that's so perfect. When I first read The Grasshopper, which was pretty recently, I was so wrapped up into this Platonic Aesop's fable. And then The Grasshopper just says, as an aside, and by the way, technological progress means that we're probably not going to have to struggle for food and shelter anymore. And, you know, I always have them read Keynes's Economic Possibilities for Our Grandchildren, where Keynes says, you know, 100 years from now, and he said this, I don't know, 97 years ago, 100 years from now, there's going to be enough food and shelter that we're not going to have to work that hard. Yeah. And I tell my students, you know, if you check the economic projections, Keynes's was dead on. As a species, despite all of the people we have enough food and shelter for everybody. So we have this one enormous, obvious problem, the political problem, the social question. Why do we have enough food and shelter for everyone and also people starving and dying from lack of food and shelter? That's question one. Question two is, if we got everyone all the food and shelter, does that mean that we have a human species has just sort of like exhausted our point and we should just wander away, right, and die?
That is literally what Suits says. Suits' yes. argument at the end of The Grasshopper is,
yes,
once we've solved technological problems, either we're bored or we play games.
Or we do something that makes us not bored.
Right.
And that's not like we've, you know, you can imagine Nietzsche like hating this because he thinks like we're not prosecuting the real struggle or whatever, and we must dominate one another or whatever the fuck it is that Nietzsche wanted for his Übermensch. But Suits is like, yeah, what you want is a really, really well-designed game and a community of players that are continually iterating on those games, and also probably art and other things.
Because this is the center of the book I'm writing right now, let me amend one tiny technicality in what you said, because I think this is super important. I think in Utopia, you don't want a game. You want a vast multiplicity of games that people have the choice between. And that, I think, is going to be central to Suits and understand, like, if you have only one game out there, you don't actually have choice.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with that more. By you want a game, I meant like you, the individual, not the culture. Because I'm guessing you're going to have your game, which for me is Rage for the Galaxy. Right. But there's also lots of other games I like to play.
Even then, I think even for the individual. Like,
yes, you're right.
This is really important to me, and this is the big finale for the book I'm writing. Like, you know, with games, unlike with other large scale institutional systems, you can be like, I'm bored of this one. Let's play something different. Like,
yeah,
I enjoyed this yesterday, but whatever, it's not interesting today. Let's flip. Maybe my mood switched. Maybe I got bored. I played Race for the Galaxy into the ground. Played like over 1,000 games of that, and I can't look at it again. Like, it makes me nauseous.
Oh, that's so sad. I'm very sorry to hear that. Look, it seems to me that in terms of our mission to talk suits, we've done it. Is there anything else you want to add?
I mean, didn't you have other goofy questions you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, I had some. I had some questions, but we just talked about suits. I mean, I did. I mean, one thing is, using the Mary Midgley's metaphor of like plumbing as game studies, plumbing for game studies. So she says philosophy is plumbing. It connects to other things. But I think you've mostly connected suits to other things, connected to Aristotle, connected to Kant. I mean, I think you've answered these questions, except I'm wondering what you're playing right now.
Oh, my old favorite German board game designer Nitya, who we thought his career was over, suddenly he's in this renaissance and he's like putting out all these new interesting games. Actually, I'm taking a lot of joy in, so this German Euro game world was particularly good, I think, at children's games. Mm-hmm. One of the great innovations was designing games that were good for people with very different skill sets. I think this is something that the American hobbyist hardcore war gamey battle techie community I grew up in was not good at. It was like, either you're a hardcore geek or it's gonna suck. And the Euro games came in this family environment that were really interested in a game in which a lot of different people could enjoy themselves, even if they have different motivations. And they built these games. I think I have this game. It's called Gulo Gulo. I don't think it's in print anymore. I bought it 20 years ago on a lark. It was on sale. And it was a kid's game, but I didn't have kids back then. And I heard it was a good drinking game. And then when I played it, I was like, I'll just put this in the back because maybe someday I'll have kids. And this weekend, I pulled it out, and my four-year-old was just delighted by it. And here's what Wolfgang Kramer, one of the great German game designers, has done. He has created Candyland, but good.
That's impossible.
but you have choice. So here's the trick. So you have these tiles that are different colors, and you slowly unveil them, and you either will advance to the next tile of a given color or flip over the last tile, and that'll force you to pick a color, to take a color. To advance, you have to get an egg. The game has this bowl of wooden eggs of different colors with a stick balanced in it precariously with a little wooden weight at the top. This is the egg alarm. So you're playing wolverines or trying to steal eggs to eat. And here's the thing. If you want to move towards to the next red, looks like Candyland, you have to snatch a red egg from this bowl in which a precariously balanced weighted stick is sticking out of the eggs without the stick falling over. Here's the interesting thing. For the strategy of the game, for actually thinking about the colors, adults have the advantage. For taking the fucking eggs out, my four-year-old won this game, despite many bad plays statistically on the board, because he could pull out the fucking eggs with his tiny fingers three times as well as anybody else. And he won, not by accident, not by us, but like he won, and he was like, my fingers are little, because I told him this. And like, I think that is board gaming genius. And it was also like hard as it was not eat, like the adults who had big fat clumsy fingers, we had to carefully strategize because we had to stare at the bowl being like, which of these eggs could I possibly take out with my huge fingers? So it was actually a hard and interesting game in which we had to do this like physics challenge and read out the complexity of this oddly balanced bowl that also play balanced adults against children. I think this is a genius game design. It's a gorgeous game design. It's not hard. It's not Go or chess, but it's a gorgeous game design.
Yeah, I that sounds amazing. The only thing I have to add is just like this sense of, I realized, honestly, actually in a conversation with a colleague who you'll hear on this podcast at some point named Aris Politopoulos, who is an archaeologist who works on games. Like he and I talked about games for my other podcast a couple of years ago. And at the end, he was like, we were able to have this great conversation, but of course it would be tough for someone to follow who doesn't play games and isn't a serious gamer or something like that. And that really struck me because I had spent the past like two decades of my life, I was last serious about StarCraft. When I say serious, I played it a lot. I wasn't good at StarCraft. Like I would play it online and just lose immediately. and that was in high school. And so I thought I wasn't a serious gamer because I had accepted this sense that like what a serious gamer was playing a certain kind of game and, you know, wouldn't even play console games because they were so into PC games and all this stuff. And I want to redefine, you know, what a serious gamer is. And I think we can use suits, right? It doesn't mean someone who's only plays serious games.
Yeah.
But someone for whom gaming is serious business, meaning important business, serious.
One of the reasons that it was so important to me, I think the most important for me, the most valuable, my favorite part of my whole book is that little argument about Twister and stupid games. Because a lot of other discussions in academia and culture about games tend to stress the ones that are overtly serious. Yeah. Oh, here's the story about like incredibly sad crap, or here's the incredibly difficult, hard, exhausting high skill game. But a lot of the most important game experiences are these simple, fun. So the game designers aren't like this. If you like read interviews with game designers who make really hardcore games, a lot of the times the ones they're the most impressed by are these elegant, simple party games with like five rules. Like they'll like whack, like they're like a couple of recent designs, like Codenames. If you have played Codenames, it's a simple party game. The design is like, there's like five rules. You can teach it in a minute. It's a fascinating mental activity that's constructed out of nothing. The Mind. Have you played The Mind?
No, I haven't.
You should play The Mind. One of the first games I teach in the game design class. I teach with a game designer faculty, Jose Zagal. The Mind is incredibly simple. The Mind, it's a cooperative game, which I normally don't like. Best played with about three or four. The deck is 1 to 100. To 100 cards labeled 1 to 100. And the first level, you randomly deal out one card to each person. And the only goal is to cooperatively play them in order. But you cannot talk.
I've heard of this, yes. You cannot signal.
You can't. And then if you get through that, then you randomize again. You get two. And then for four people, if you can deal out 8 cards and in silence, without signaling, play them in order. It's gorgeous. It's an extraordinary experience. It's incredibly simple. When we played this in our classroom, and Jose, his first question was like, okay, what is this game about? And my students were like, it's about time and intimacy. And we're like, yes, that is a game about time and intimacy. And it's like, you know, it's the rules. There's one rule. I can teach it in a minute. It's amazing. But maybe here's something we should finish on. Something for you to work on in your podcast.
Okay.
I think the easy question is, what is a game? The hard question is, what is play? I've been trying to figure out an account of play for like 10 years, and I don't have one yet. And I think when people talk about games, they want to center hardcore or super serious games a lot of the time. But I think if you actually center the concept of play, you'll find the heart of everything that's missing from the rest of philosophy and the world. Like, I mean, and people in this space know it. Like, a lot of people will say, like, look, what the center of this stuff is play, and we really need to talk about what playfulness is and how games cultivate playfulness. And that is, for me, an incredibly deep and incredibly hard question.
Yeah, I agree. I am working on that. I am working on that. Graeber writes on this, which is very important to me. Mary Midsley writes on this, which is very important to me. And then I'll bring this back to Suits. The place where Suits utterly loses me is he has these appendices where Wittgensteinians, you know, tear his argument apart. As I've said, like, I think rightfully tear it apart if it's an attempt to have a unified theory of all games. Wrong if it's about how useful it is. And what he's confronted by in one of these appendices is the fact that his theory of games doesn't account for play and playfulness. And Suits says, so we can simply conclude that games and play have nothing to do with one another. And I do not accept this answer.
Yeah,
I do not accept this answer.
Maybe a better answer is in Maria Lagunas. Have you read Maria Lagunas?
I have a little. I'm working my way through, but yeah, absolutely.
I mean, her account from the amazing paper on loving attention and world traveling and playfulness is that what play is to travel between different rule worlds and hold none of them sacred and step lightly between them. And I think like that's that's something that isn't in Suits that is also at the center of whatever's important.
I would also recommend Clifford Geertz's legendary essay, Deep Play, Notes on the Balinese Cockfight, which I've been teaching for a long time and I'm just now bringing into dialogue with play studies. I realized that Geertz and Graeber, I was engaging with play in a lot of places without having come around to game studies. And so the play stuff I've thought about, the game stuff is that's new to me. And there has to be, it has to be something about, you know, I gave my like one sentence definition of a game is like, it's a, like a form of boundaries for play, something like that, which is an attempt to kind of have Suits, but stick play in there also. And that's not something I've worked out in like an analytic way. I couldn't defend it against, you know, attacks, but that's what I'm working on, a form of boundaries for play.
Do you want my version of this? It's showing up in the new book I'm writing right now.
Yes,
this is
please.
Like, this is,
and then, and then I'll finally let you go.
So, okay, I'll do the big picture because this is related to our last conversation. So I've been working a lot on bureaucracy and rules. And one of the last time we talked about one of the key ideas coming from, for me, from Lorraine Daston, who's an intellectual historian, working on the idea of a mechanical rule. So a mechanical rule is something that anybody can follow. And she thinks that we get this transition from like rules that acquire subtlety and discernment to these mechanical rules that anyone can follow. And that's part of the drive to having low skill fungible workers who can apply anything. So I had this whole theory built on Daston about how that sucked the life out of everything. And I was like, the problem is this doesn't explain why games are good, because games have clear, accessible, mechanical rules. So here's the new theory. Games give you different rules that are clear, and they let you leap between vastly different normative ways of being. You can play the mind, then you can play Go, then you can play basketball, then you play. And all these clear, accessible rules let you quickly shift and travel easily between worlds, a la Legones. The big difference between games and large-scale institutional structures is that large-scale institutional structures typically impose a single rule set that you can't escape. And so that inculcates the opposite of play. But having a huge variety of games that you can step lightly between at your choice uses mechanical rules as a tool for play because it makes transitions easier. So a lot of what matters is the variety and voluntariness is of our ability to move between games. That's my attempt at Suits plus Legones plus Daston to explain what's the difference between games and bureaucracy. What do you think, buddy?
Yeah, I was going to say, do you want my answer now?
Tell me.
Okay, so the first thing to say is, now we're getting back into that other mode. Yeah. We're just throwing ideas at each other. The first thing to say is, I don't think you can trust these large-scale institutions' accounts of how their own internal workings are functioning, which is to say, everyone knows that like sometimes the most famous professor is actually an idiot. And even if that guy's not an idiot, they might be a terrible dissertation director, but maybe that guy's directing everyone's dissertations because he's so famous and his students get jobs. There's actually, you'll always find that person with someone else on the same committee who is actually directing the dissertation. And so like a Daston style explanation of like, oh, these institutions are actually, you know, imposing these things. You must have this person, you must have this guy as your dissertation director or you won't get a job. But actually that guy's not directing anyone's dissertations except on paper, and the rules have totally missed the actual human activities, to use another anarchist thinker, Colin Ward, the seed beneath the snow that is actually the thing that's growing and flourishing, and the organization is taking credit for something that not only has its rules not created, but its rules are actually binding. Right. That's my first response.
Right. Yeah, I think we might be analyzing different parts of the institution. I'm looking at the part where the institution forces down a set of rules that an individual worker has to follow. And I think my suspicion is that the example, our key examples look, are gonna, your example is focused on a different power relationship in the institution than the ones I'm thinking about. Well, whatever. Talk about that some other day.
How about this one? When I fill out an IT ticket request,
yeah,
the really important thing is that the worker closes the ticket,
yeah,
and I give them a thumbs up.
Right.
And that's very important to the institution, but it doesn't bear that well on whether my IT problem, right, was fixed. But nevertheless, people are fixing the IT problems in the institution, right, or the institution wouldn't be working. Yeah. But the rules and the numerical evaluation of whether the IT problems are getting fixed seems to me to be pretty separate.
Oh yeah, we forgot. You're much more optimistic than me.
Yeah, I know.
Human life can flourish inside at the edges of institutional rule sets.
Yeah, I do. Or underneath. Yeah. And then the last thing I'll say, and then I will finally let you go, is the example I always use for this is the Eurostep,
yeah,
which was always within the rules of basketball, and it was the constraint of the rules and probably of certain forms of defenses, although I wouldn't think zone defenses. I've got to think what created the Eurostep. That, you know, so someone very playful, I don't know who, created the Eurostep within the boundary of rules. And then when it was imported to the United States, it was called as a travel, even though it fit the rules perfectly. It does not require an additional step until that particular form of bounded play came to be understood as within the rules, which it always was, but it was also a form of like emergent play that people couldn't handle Manu Ginobili doing it. So I'm thinking about the Eurostep here.
Yeah.
If that helps at all.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll just have to carry this along some other time. T, thank you so much for your time. This is such a pleasure.
Thank you, man.